copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Today, Amoke and I are working together. Amoke is the real expert, I think, in this area. But before she talks to us, I'm going to talk about the issue of pornography. With apologies, I know a few of you may have remember some of this was covered when we did the whole network on sexuality a few years ago. But I think there's enough of us not here to bear thinking about this again. And what I want to do is to set all of today in the context of the reality of the maelstrom, the storm of the sexual revolution that's taken place over the past half century. The moral and relational, what we might call settlement, agreement of Western culture that's prevailed for centuries, has in the course of just 50 years comprehensively broken down. It's what's called, some people call, narrative collapse. And we're at the moment in Western Europe, the very Western fringes, in the final wave of the collapse of that moral and relational settlement that's been in place for centuries. Okay? It began 50 years ago, it's accelerated over the past 15 years. And that settlement was based around three propositions. First, that gender is binary and to be received as such, male, female. That sexual interests are normatively expressed between sexes. And thirdly, that human flourishing is linked to the ordering of sexual intimacy within the covenant of marriage. Okay? So those are the three propositions that have been at the heart of the moral and relational settlement of centuries. I'll just repeat them. That gender is binary and to be received as such. That sexual interests are normatively expressed heterosexually between the sexes. And thirdly, that human flourishing is intricately linked to the notion that sex is for the covenant of marriage. Okay, they're the three that are broken down. And the scale and the pace of the sexual revolution is quite extraordinary. And this is a high street shop in my own town, Ann Summers, which many of you will know of. Chain, is it in Europe, Eastern Europe? It's all over England. Is it in... No, but here you can buy, as you can see, there's some chains and whips here. And this is a high street. This, 30 years ago, would have been in Soho, but this is what children and people can just see as they go past. And there is full of sex toys and sex aids. This is a previous mayor of Bristol, my own town. And these are Bangkok ladyboys, and they are either transsexual, transgendered, or transvestite young men from Thailand who put on what I'm told is a spectacular show that is hugely popular in across Britain and tours Britain and Europe. You may have seen it, the Bangkok ladyboys. And some of these boys are simply transvestite boys dressed as girls. Some have had a full operation. Others have had half an operation. So some may have a penis and breasts. And you're having a variation. And what's so fascinating is the mainstreaming of this phenomena, this overturning of one of those key propositions that we talked about, that gender is binary and to be received as such. We see the overturning of this in this cultural phenomenon. And what's even more interesting is that we have the mayor of Bristol, one of the central figures of civic respectability, being kissed on either side by two of these. So we have a celebration, not just an inclusion of this new norm, but a celebration of it. And then here we have, this is the wife of the Prime Minister of Great Britain, the previous Prime Minister Gordon Brown, on a gay pride march flanked by transsexuals. So you can see that if you want to change a culture, as the sociologist Peter Berger said, what you've got to do is get hold of your opinion leaders, your thought leaders, your social models, your cultural entrepreneurs, your media influencers, and you project them as advocates of the new norm. And to see how successful this revolution has been, you just need to see that we have central figures of influence and authority, as well as huge commercial backing and interests, behind the overturning of that old cultural settlement that prevailed for centuries. It all happened in just 50 years. And although it began 50 years ago in the individualism of the 60s, that's where it began, it's accelerated massively in the past 15 to 20 years with the growing influence of what's called queer theory. And I only want to mention this because queer theory is basically an academic discipline dedicated to the questioning, the overturning of those three propositions, particularly propositions 1 and 2, that gender is binary and that sexual interests are normatively expressed between, in a complementary way, the sexes. And queer theory is the academic underpinning for the challenging and overturning of those propositions. And it's rooted in the work of the philosopher Michel Foucault, and it's been popularized academically in the work of Judith Butler. And this theory is gaining remarkable traction culturally through the means that I've just illustrated: cultural entrepreneurs, the culture changers, the media people. And so we see that this breakdown is expressed in captivating imagery. And of course, well, the Eurovision Song Contest, I'm sure we were all glued to that. Didn't see it, I suppose no one saw it, did you? But you'll have seen the guy who won it, who is a poster boy for essentially queer theory. That it doesn't matter who you are, what you are, all that matters is two people love each other. Whatever those people conceive themselves to be in terms of their identity. This is a culture in which you make yourself up as you go along, because there's no norm. And this afternoon I'm in one of the workshops trying to unpack this a little further in terms of the consequences and the phenomena of this sexual revolution and the impact it's having and the failure of the church to respond to it. But, and here's some of the consequences, the breakdown of any sense of normative means that in our culture, young people now are getting fed up of titles. So we're moving from labels, from gay, straight, lesbian, to bigender, pansexual, omnisexual, trisexual, polyamorous, LGBTQ+. Hey, forget labels. That's the prevailing culture. We're just queer. And queer young people who have no sense of a way in which we should walk make themselves up as they go along under that title of "we're just queer." Queer means I construct myself. Okay? And the repercussions of this are unknown. We are in uncharted territory, essentially, in terms of the sexual development of our young people. And if we're thinking about the consequences, there are two big ones in society: the collapse of marriage in England. By the age of 16, more than a half of children will only have one parent in England. Such is the collapse of marriage. In a population of 60 million, we have 3 million children with only one parent. And most of those, it's without a father. We have a generation of boys with no role models, a generation of girls with no man to relate to, who loves them and cares for them and models for them some sort of respectable, virtuous concept of manhood. And we have a generation of kids. And one of the greatest causes of social inequality is the collapse of marriage. So when people say, I'm interested in equality, I say, I'm interested in equality. One of the greatest inequalities is the collapse of that old settlement that sexual interests. We flourish within the covenant of marriage. And the fallout of the collapse of that settlement falls upon 3 million kids, the most vulnerable and the weakest in society. That is one of the major consequences. And one of the fascinating second subheading of the collapse of marriage is the rise of lone households, particularly amongst people in their 50s and 60s. I don't know whether you remember C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce. Any of you read that? He has a wonderful, chilling picture that hell is a place where you just have to think of a house and you can have it. So it's terribly easy. If you fall out with your neighbor, you don't need to resolve that relationship. You not only make yourself up, you make up your environment in hell. You just think of a new house, you can have one, a nicer palace, beautiful place. But of course, because everybody is thinking new environments, they're pushing further and further away from each other and out into space, essentially lost by themselves, in themselves. And I think what's terribly interesting is that the rise of lone... Never have so many people in England lived alone. And it's a fascinating exemplar of that, what we're seeing as a biblical truth, that the devil offers more and more, but always gives you less and less, until in the end he's got it all, and you've got nothing. You're living alone. So the sexual revolution, which offers us free love and all you want in relationship, in the end delivers you nothing but loneliness. And that is a cultural critique that we need to regain our confidence around, that the gospel really is good news for people. The sexual mandate, the sexual constraints of Scripture are for flourishing. Okay. Anyway, that's the context. What the other consequence that we're going to talk about over the next few minutes is the pornification of society. Just break there. Do you want to chip in any thoughts, observations, wisdom, questions?
I just wanted to make sure what was the queer theory. Yeah.
Yes.
And the word queer, does it come from the from the author of the theory? Because the word is on.
Yeah. What a great question. Why are we called Christians? Do you know? How did we get to be called Christians originally?
Christ. Oh, yeah. Because we follow Christ.
Like a little Christ.
One of the islands.
A little Christ.
A little Christ?
Yeah, like
is that why?
Follower.
And was it a term of respect?
No.
It was mocking us, all right? They called Christians. They follow the bloke who got crucified. Yeah. You know, Christians. It was a term of derision. And what Christians did was they took that term of exclusion and derision and they held it with pride as to who they were, their identity. Now, what queer theory has done is basically copied that phenomenon. One of the words of abuse and exclusion of people who have same-sex attraction, who are, quote, gay, unquote, if you want to use those terms, is queer. He's queer. He's not a queer, is he? That was the usual term when I was a kid. He's a bit of a queer. They say he's a queer. You know, it was the ultimate, almost badge of exclusion and difference. You're queer. And so what they did was they took that label and owned it as a badge of identity to assert their difference and their right to be different. Okay, so it's queer theory, gay and proud. Okay, it's a great question. Thank you. Yeah. Any other points? Yes, Martin.
Is anyone really thinking about consequences? For example, I can imagine life in the education system, in primary schools, how teachers would have to cope with children coming who don't recognise who they are, to be honest, and how you, you know, operate an education system where all of this is going on.
It's a great question. You see, nobody is thinking about the end game of this. Mm-hmm. And amongst Christians, theologians, nobody is doing any decent intellectual work on queer theory, except somebody I met here who got the vision here last year and just started a PhD on this. So, you know, we need young, sharp, our best young minds dealing with this, and we got to pray for that. Great point, Martin. Yeah. Right, anything else? It's really a question about how we construct our sense of our subjective sense of identity and the way that our culture captures that away from us and invites us to live our identity exteriorly in the virtual realities. And there was a great report produced by the government's chief scientific officer in England 18 months ago, called Future Identities, and saying, because of exactly what Philippa you've just said, the possibility to reinvent yourself in as many ways you want, there's a real question about how we're going to form a sense of inner continuity in the next few years. And it raised, that report says, what are the impact on the formation of identity for young people? What we're talking about this morning is we're stripping away any way in which, any path of expectation, any way in which we should walk in terms of sexual development here. That's well underway. And I think Martin makes the point about our being in uncharted territory. David. Oh, sorry, Richard. I'm insisting on calling you Dave. I'm so sorry.
Whatever you want.
Yeah, let's make you up as you go along.
just that last point you said about identity of that is a question. But with the ACC, I don't know if you know about it, something
Association
of Christian Counselors in England have actually sent out a directive that we must obey the law, and I know it's against this where same-sex attraction, it's a program in America, isn't it? Reparative.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because they want to be against that, we must never counsel anybody to change from being same-sex attracted.
Yeah.
Now, I know there are issues in terms of individual counseling and your setting and everything else, but what happens if, like, as a counsellor, I'm belonging to that group, you're with a youth group, we're saying, well, how should we start to think about this? You would say, well, ask the pastor.
It's a great point. Yes, the point is that if any sort of counsellor's therapist can't respond in terms of any expected norm, that it's about affirmation of one's sense of given identity. And what we're saying is terribly confusing, because essentially there are two scripts at work. One is there's gay and straight and that's it. The other is, hey, forget those old labels of gay or straight, it's LGBTQIPQ, you know, queer, let's fit post-label. And so there are two scripts going along, and young people are, which one do you go by? We're in uncharted territory. And actually, can I leave that point just hanging? Because this was just context to pornification, okay? If you're not going anywhere this afternoon and you want to talk about this more, this is the whole area of the workshop I'm doing this afternoon, so do come along at 4:15, because it's quite a really stimulating, interesting topic, I think. The pornification of society, 4.2 million websites, these are way out of date, these data. I mean, it's almost impossible to keep up. Average age first internet exposure, 11, 90% age 16-year-olds have viewed porn. Again, in a generation, the impact on young people of being exposed to imagery which portrays sex in terms of this particular script is at the moment unknown. And what we want to do is think about pornography and its consequences for the next 20 minutes under these three headings: biological, behavioural and relational. Okay, so let's take biological first, and all of these slides, you know, you can download again. But biological, do you remember we said when we were talking about opiates yesterday that substances use your brain against you? But it doesn't have to be a physical substance to get a hold of the very chemicals of your brain. Environment can change our brains as well. And most of you have heard me, you must be sick of hearing it, but in case some of you haven't, the London taxi driver study, and here's the study that in a way sparked all of the interest in what's called neuroplasticity, the plastic nature of the brain that responds to its environment. Because what they found was that London taxi drivers, the bit of the brain that looks after maps, mapping, telling where you are, is larger. And what was more interesting than that was that the longer you've been taxi driving, the larger it gets, which is pretty good evidence, not absolutely confirmatory, but pretty good evidence that we become the choices we make. Okay? The things we choose to do, the behaviours we cultivate and nurture, the patterns we kindle in our lives, actually are literally embodied. They shape our brain structure. And they do it by tightening the links called synapses between brain cells. And we have billions of brain cells, and each of those has an average of about 20 links with other brain cells. So the number of links is incredible, but it's these links that can weaken or tighten. And if you taxi drive, those bits that the brain involved in that tighten, and you may even get what's called neurogenesis, some new cells forming, but you get more cells pulled into this activity and more tightening as the hands reach out to do more map reading. Can I hold it, Philip? I'll just keep going a sec if I might. So this is the brain that makes itself, and it's expressed in some of the neurotransmitter systems as well that we talked about with heroin, the brain reward and pleasure systems. Okay? And I'm going to show you pretty much the same diagram as yesterday, the reward and pleasure systems. Now, we've all got a reward and pleasure system in our brain. You know, you feel good, you have a great meal, and you have a nice glass of wine after sex. There are lots of pleasures in life, aren't there? And you think, why? Where did this come from? What are they for, these reward pleasure systems? Well, I think there are two big reasons they're there. The first is they direct us toward and reinforce important things in our lives. So it's a kind of an evolutionary or a biological factor that keeps us doing the things that are good for us. It's interesting. So the way we've developed and the way we've been created is that pleasure's linked to the things that we need to keep doing to survive. And you've got a drink, and oh, if you're thirsty, isn't the pleasure if you're, you know, and then you have a drink, and it's one of the most quintessential pleasures to have your thirst quenched. Pleasure. And food and relationships. You meet somebody, have a great conversation, very viscerally pleasurable. And to ensure our literal survival in sex. If we didn't have sex, we wouldn't have babies, no human beings. So pleasures associated with rewarding things that are important. Okay. Now the biblical framework in which we embed that says, of course, our pleasures have a deeper quality and meaning in that they point beyond the immediate experience to some deeper pleasure, some lasting experience of ecstasy and joy. And of course the scriptures say, eye hasn't seen, no one's heard, the mind of man hasn't even got the capacity yet to conceive, to understand what God has in store for those who love him. The pleasures of God, intensely orgasmic, beautiful, pleasurable. These are God's. They're not the devil's. They're ours. They're his. And the pleasures of this life always point beyond themselves to that nostalgia. We might say nostalgic reaction. Something in us longs for. And C.S. Lewis said, you know, when you have a pleasure, I don't know whether you've felt this, you somehow want to, you want completeness, but it's never quite as complete as you'd hoped. He says you see a beautiful picture and somehow you want to go into it and then it's not there anymore. The sense of being pulled beyond, but the thing itself isn't quite satisfying. The scent of a woman, he says, gives you a reminder of something, but she can't quite fulfill that smell, that perfume that it's pointing to. He says it's all of these pleasures are just scents, they're perfumes, they're a little smell, they're a little taste of an ultimate pleasure for which our heart longs. Okay? So we can see these brain reward pleasure systems are integral to our being made human in the image of God in anticipation of our final calling and our final state, which is all about ecstasy and consummation. The Bible ends, if you remember, in Revelation with a picture of sex, consummation. So sex is ours, folks, not theirs. It's not his, the devil. This is our God-given right and pleasure, along with great food and wonderful tastes and smells, feelings. Gosh, I'm getting excited about this. I'm going to stop. Can't take a cold shower. And do you remember we said there are two separate pleasure systems? The excitatory system, dopamine-related. The satisfying system, endorphin-related. And what drugs do is they drive this in a way that drives the seeking behavior, the wanting behavior. And that is exactly what pornography is thought to do. You don't have to court a girl. You don't have to take her out for dinner. You don't have to any foreplay. There's none of that nonsense. You don't have to spend money on a meal, for goodness sake. You just click the button and you have instant access. And endorphin is being floods your brain, and serotonin, and also dopamine's being stoked up. The whole thing, the interplay is quite complex and not well understood. But you are driving your brain chemistry in a quite unnatural way. And you are pumping up the balloon until you close down the lid. And then, of course, the balloon begins to collapse. And then, once again, the craving begins to start to satisfy that pleasure. And people vary in the degree to which pornography hooks them in the sense that we understand addiction patterns in, say, heroin or other substances. Some people are much less susceptible. We need to be clear about that. But some people, just like alcoholics who seem to be so predisposed with porn, just it hooks them and they're captured in a typically addictive pattern. And that's what's going on. And so we said biological, behavioral relational, these are the behavioural consequences, and this is the addictive patterns, narrows the range of stimuli, others can no longer compete. Sex with your wife, that's really complicated, and you know, you've got all the headaches and stuff negotiating, and you've got to talk and that. Whereas the wonderful thing about pornography is control. You have control. It's effortless. It's effortless. And so who can compete with that? Tolerance develops, however, and so there's the phenomenon of people getting into harder and harder core experiences. You get withdrawal effects because dopamine has been deregulated. Its relationship with endorphins and serotonin has got out of sync and it's overactive, and so we're wanting. Loss of control. I will do anything to get this. Now, I begin to take risks that someone may see. Hey, hell, who cares? I need this now, even if one of my children may come in. I forget that. I need this. And of course, then, as typically addictions, they harm, it impacts social, occupational, relational goals, and numbing of the relationship with your wife is one of the key ones. Biological, behavioral, and then numbing takes us into relational consequences. Numbing of intimacy, intolerance of slow sex. So this is the sort of fast food of sex. It's the McDonald's of sex. It's the quick hit. It's the Starbucks frothy whatever, you know, 600 calories a cup. This is the quick way in, and there's rapidly developing tolerance. I need to get the sex, and I haven't got time to go through this with my wife, and that leads to a breakdown of the relationship, accompanied by deception and secretiveness and desensitization of conscience. Yes, Tim. The question, should we educate people about what's happening here and seek to entice them back into what we would see as a healthy relationship with our sexuality, which is linked to, it's essentially slow sex embedded in a relationship and all the messiness of the relationship. That, I think that is really the goal. The problem is how you get there, isn't it? And we're just coming on to that. Before we do look at interventions, I just want to talk briefly about the biblical model that contains all that I've just shown. So we pull the lens back again, okay? And there are just two factors that I want to remind us of in terms of the biblical model that contains these understandings. The first is the heart and its idolatry. Remember, the heart is wanting, and because of its brokenness, always wants more from a pleasure than that pleasure can ever give. Because the pleasures of life are anticipatory. They always have this slightly unfulfilled quality to them because they're pointing us beyond to a deeper realization in God Himself. And the pleasures of life always offer us what we can only get in God, which makes them an idol. And so we want more from the pleasures of life than they can ever give us. So pleasure has become an idol because we're seeking from it a level of intimacy and pleasure, or the godlike rush of pleasure. It could be as gods. Having sex, you're in control. The sense of control and mastery of pornography. You're in charge. You click the buttons. You decide. You're watching this woman being abused and humiliated. You can be as gods. You shall live forever. Just a moment in being carried along by that, you see. The dream seems to be true, that maybe you can be as gods, until you close the lid. And then the dopamine begins to slowly build again. And you realize you're not a god. You're a broken addict like this man. A cosy desio me mena, and so desire carries me along, captive. So the heart and its idolatry, and the second is lust, the biblical concept of lust, which is sex in the wrong context. And we need to be clear when we're talking about pornography that Scripture, whatever the factors that may have led somebody down that track, which we've recognized yesterday with substances, we don't know what they've gone through. We didn't have the broken home they had. We don't have to travel so far as they have to travel to get off this stuff. But at the end of the day, whatever those understandings, we must hold people in the dignity of being human. They click the button, nobody else. They must hold that responsibility. And this is sin. Okay? It's lust. It's taking something that God gives as good and making it perverted. I need to hold people to that. So, with that biblical model, what can we do pastorally and in a counselling context to intervene here? Well, I've got, I think, four headings, but the first one is pastorally, so it doesn't have to be a professional counselling. In a church, I would urge people who develop a confidence in working pastorally with people to work along these lines. Okay? First of all, acceptance. I just think acceptance is probably the thing that's worth spending more time on than anything else.
We fail right there at the acceptance point.
Yeah.
Because people do not feel accepted, they feel judged right away by the, you know.
Because they feel judged and excluded by us, they judge and exclude themselves, and what happens? They compartmentalize. You know, the psychological phenomena of separated emotional, cognitive, and behavioral lives. So the porn, that person there who does porn, well, it's me, but somehow it's not quite me. I'm here, and I slide into that person, and I come out, and I don't want to think about that until I'm caught. And so there's no integration. Yes. Yeah.
I think what is missing, the first point, it's not acceptance, but it's acknowledging. It's like, as a mental health, speaking that there are people among us struggling with that. So speaking among the students or in the church, and kind of having the open door to talk, to bring this subject into the church.
Great.
Which is even before acceptance.
Okay, so we might want to put the word in acknowledgement there. Great point. And I'm thinking of these as being personal, to be honest with you, personal realities. So personal realities, to acknowledge that this person in front of the computer is me. I think that's a really important psychological, and I will spend time with people. I've not got a vast amount of experience. Amoki will have more, but I, my instincts are to spend time on those first two. Acceptance, by integration, I mean to fully integrate this behavior on my part into my identity. This is who I am. This is what I do, not some other person. It's me. And I think that's a slow, painful process. And in its deepest sense, it means that I integrate and accept that that person who does those things is me, a child of God, a son of God, a daughter of God. Women tend to do literary pornography more than visual. But, you know, this is me, a daughter, a noble son of God. I open that computer. This is the one who opens the computer. And again, people compartmentalize that there's that person who does that, and then there's who I am in Christ. No. The person who does that is who you are in Christ, doing that. And it's quite an important move. I think that's quite an important cognitive and emotional journey for somebody to make. And as we make, help them make it, we stand with them. We accept them, as your point, Ian. We acknowledge them. We love them. And we refuse to allow them to be anything less than that noble, called child of God that they are, who's doing porn. And I think that's what Paul, you remember when he says, don't you know that you take the very body of Christ into a prostitute? You don't. He insists that they stay integrated. They take Christ in to have sex with that woman. And so as his ambassador, his noble brother, God's their father's son, they watch pornography. That's the guy who's watching pornography. And I think then we lead to authentic confession. Confession that comes from the heart. And again, linger over making our confessions and receiving a sense of forgiveness and being with someone and offering them God's the authority to offer someone God's forgiveness, because we believe he will. And insisting on repentance, which is a turning from. Let's not forget these simple, critical, biblical steps of restoration. You know, you see some people, I saw a guy fallen by the waist, you know, fall into a bad situation and been put out of ministry. And he went into counselling. He wanted to tell me all about his counselling. And I wanted him to tell me about his confession for what he'd done to that person. And it was very odd. I'm the psychiatrist wanting to hear him talk about confession. He's the priest wanting to talk about counselling, you know. But we're Christian counsellors, and we mustn't let go of those cardinal things. I think the next point is, and this is both contextual and individual, we need churches that aren't so much about what they're against in the area of sex, but what we're for. And if we just implement, you see, I haven't said anything about behavioural controls yet. We haven't talked about getting covenant eyes on your computer and accountability group and stopping it and feeling ashamed. We haven't mentioned any of that. We must capture their hearts with a better vision than the one they've got. And that's a contextual church calling. But it's something that we need to convey to the person. Yeah, there's something better than this. And to convey to them that what they're seeking isn't entirely wrong. When they're checking into the porn, what they're looking at isn't... It has the seeds of huge goodness and flourishing there. It's God's gift of sex. It's just in the wrong place, in the wrong time, between the wrong people. But the thing itself, their heart's reaching in the right direction. And we need to keep that and affirm it in them, that their instinct to want sex is good. There's nothing wrong with it. But we need to capture that within a better vision, contextually and individually. And for that we need teaching in our churches. We've got to get this out of shame and into the pulpit, into our mainstream discourse. Sex is an icon, isn't it? A relationship between the Father, the Son and the Holy Spirit, the Trinity. It's an icon of the relationship between Jesus and his church. It's an anticipation of the pleasures of God that are to come. And it's a divine seal on the great creation mandate to have kids. And God blessed that with making it an intensely joyous thing to have kids. So it's all of those things. Why aren't we talking about this? It's a core part of our... So, finally, captured by pastoral, captured by a better vision, now we go into some behavioural controls. Accountability is really important. Behavioural controls such as computer controls. But remember that it's not just about computers, it's phones, all the other things as well. And then in counselling, relational work, rebuilding the intimacy skills between a husband and wife is really important. And that's an extended, intuitive, dependent intervention, because it's going to affect couples in different ways, and you've got to work with how it's emerging. You may get a wife who just doesn't want to talk to her husband for the next month. Thank you, having found this out. So rebuilding intimacy skills. You know, it's probably a 4-5 year project, because depending on how serious the pornography has been for this individual, you know, if it's a really serious, but there are lots of less, you know, we mustn't over dramatize this. Lots of people check into pornography and it doesn't hook them, it doesn't, you know, so there is a spectrum. But for those who are really drawn into it, their brain may have been shaped, their relationships so shaped by the deception, secretiveness, the sense of shame, the compartmentalization, that it's going to take quite some while for them to rediscover friendship, trusting friendship, you know, a loving relationship with wife. And I think one needs to take the long view on that last bullet point of which I think is your point, isn't it? It's not just with wife, it's a multifaceted. Please, any other wisdom, thoughts? Transgenderism is really complicated. It's zooming up the priority list in terms of pastoral issues. I've had quite a few folk come to me here and said, want to talk about transgenderism. It seems to be occurring in more churches, more young people. Can we land on the point you finish with, which it's very complicated? I think it would need an hour's, 2 hours time on it again at some point. But, you know, these issues are... I was talking to a pastor in the north of England. He said he'd just moved to a church. It was a new church plant. They'd been going a year. He said, I've already got a lesbian couple and a transgender person in my congregation of 80. They'd been drawn into things, and he felt at sea pastorally. So I'd love to say Amoke is going to answer all our questions, but we're not doing transgenderism today, so I'm going to hand over to Amoke. Thanks so much.
Okay, the case I brought to you is a non-Christian, and I purposely picked somebody who is not a Christian, but he is not an atheist either. He is a 36-year-old man. Actually, it wasn't him who came to see me, but his fiancée. And she came because she found out that he's addicted to pornography, and he is also regularly visiting prostitutes. They've been living together for 2 years when she came to see me, and it was totally devastating for her. And she said, the only way I will marry this man, if he starts doing therapy and he starts doing something for himself, and if I see that there's a progress in his life. So he voluntarily started therapy with me. What we know about him is that he is a member from a family of Jehovah Witnesses. He denied his faith. He came away from his church. His church was very angry and persecutive with him for that, because his father actually is the pastor of the church. He is in high leadership of the Jehovah Witnesses church. What I would like you to know about him is I want to give you an impression that I had of him. Here I had his fiance, and then he called in, and right away when I picked up the phone, because I always tell them, please, he has to call me. You cannot make an appointment for him. So he called me up, and I listened to his voice on the phone, and I said, ah, music to my ears. What a beautiful male voice. Then he comes to the first session. I opened the door, and I stand there and I look at him, and I'm trying to hide my first impression. Michelangelo's David is alive. This is beauty in front of me. And my first reaction was, God, you're great. No, I was thinking, God, you're great. But looking at him was, how can a man like this have such problems? He's a successful businessman. He is loved by many friends. He has many friends. He is beautiful to look at. His voice is beautiful. He's a smart man. He has a deep heart, he has emotions, he's very much in touch with his emotions and with people. But he has often been taken advantage of. He is very frustrated. It comes out very soon in our conversation that he's frustrated with himself because that he feels that he has no vision for the future. He has no idea who he is or what he can be. And he is a very strong introvert. And with the domineering father that he has all the reasons to be an introvert. His father is very critical, very blaming, very demanding. And I always ask my clients about their image of God. And he said, threatening, demanding, and angry. What a parallel between his father and with the image of God, and that you will find often that there is a great parallel between it. I brought you this case study because I would like you to just throw your hunches at me. What are the things that you would try? Before I start the next session, I would like to hear what ideas you have. How would you approach a person like this? Beautiful, successful man sitting in front of you. He wants his relationship with his fiancée. His fiancée is... actually, I forgot to say, she is a Christian girl. She claims to be a born-again Christian. So he is living a very unhealthy and sinful lifestyle. He has a very emotionally and spiritually abused background. How would you start? What are your hunches? Really, I don't want any perfect answer, but I would like to get information from you because I think the more ideas we get, the wider our perspective on treatment would be. How would you start? Yes, Anna.
That will sound simple, but still, the first thought that came to my mind that I would really want to get to know him more and to ask him about being a child, being a little boy, what was it like? You know, so under this big and handsome and, you know, strong man that you described, just to get in touch with the, you know, boy and the person that he once was. So it gives a bigger and wider picture of his vulnerability and, you know, just to get to know him at the first point.
That's very good. Thank you. It's something I did too. Any other ideas? Yes. Please, let's all...
One of the things that I'll probably ask is, what do you want to get out of this therapy? I mean, and why is he there? And what is he wants to... What is the goal for him? Or what does he want to change in?
Excellent, yes. See, he came because his fiancée kind of pulled him into the trap. I mean, I said voluntarily, but one of the reasons I picked this case, because many times people will come with addiction because of a relationship that they treasure. It's a primary reason. Why would you want to stop something that has been, in quote, fulfilling until now? Why would you want to quit something that you have enjoyed until now? There must be a deep motivation, and many times it's a relationship. So it is very good to ask, okay, now your fiancé got you into coming, and actually I joked with him too. I said, I understand this is very voluntarily, that's the only way you get to marry, huh? And after a while, I asked him what Glenn was just saying earlier. Are you okay with what you're doing? I actually did start to bring him to admitting that this is not good. And actually, I did not allow him to go and describe this situation as it's only about our relationship. Because it isn't. It's not just about the relationship. And I made it very clear to him at the very beginning that even if this girl would break up with you and you could go on with your life, or the other way, you would marry and have a wonderful marriage, which we will not with this addiction, it is your identity that will be destroyed through this. So it is important to ask that. Any other ideas? Please help me. Give me new ideas. I am bored with my methods.
When and how everything starts, because I know my situation. That was a really important situation, how everything started, what's happened in that moment when I first got pornography magazine. Yeah.
Okay, so you would ask, how did it start? Where was the beginning? Where do we trace it back? Yeah, it's a very good one. Many times I go and I try to find, is there a one specific event that you can line it back to? But most of the time you can't. Sometimes you can, but most of the time you can't really tell. I don't know if you heard of Ted Bundy, a serial killer in America. I was a teenager, a political refugee in America, when the Ted Bundy case came on. And I was shocked by it because to me, from a communist country, it was a totally new world. And I remember that before his execution, it was James Dobson who was the only one allowed to go in and do a report with him. It would worth for you to look at the picture of him. He was a good-looking businessman. And when James Dobson asked him, how did it all start? He said, you know, as a teenager, I just started to look at pornographic magazine. That's where it started. So the beginning of it is very important. And what we have heard throughout the mornings, addiction always needs more because the amount is not satisfying after a while. And Ted Bundy said, I just needed to increase it. From pictures, I needed to go to videos. From the videos, I needed to go to people. I think, if I remember right, he killed 47 women after raping them. So where did it start is a very good question. Any other questions?
I was just thinking, would you find out how, you know, on a day-to-day level, how this works out in his life? So, you know, each day, how is it part of his life? And, you know, what does he do to make sure it happens? And
You would ask how he fits it in his day?
Yeah.
One of the things I do, based on that one, I mentioned it to you earlier, I make a map with them. I map the process. Say, you leave from work, how was your day at work? And many times I actually make them chart down. Literally have a chart, a map, on a piece of paper. And keep on adding details that you discover. One of the things that this man said, and it's a typical thing, I was frustrated at work. So from this comment, I know that he has an issue with frustration. He doesn't have the tools to deal with it. And then he would say, on the way home, I would pick up the phone. Okay. I ask him, do you, on the way home, always pick up the phone? No. I'm glad I don't have to talk to anybody. Because he's an introvert, see? He usually doesn't want to talk to people. So when you pick up the phone, why do you pick up the phone? Oh, because I'm looking for a call girl's name. He had a list of girls on the phone. So that's the next step. But see, if we go through the whole process, the whole line, the road that he's going to travel, one of the benefits that you will have is that you can start cutting back. You will be able to see the different routes that he could take off from that one specific route. Anything else? Yeah.
That it would be very important to start from a non-judgmental position, and I think I would also try to look for resources for other people who would support him through the week, and even to offer some support
Yes, thank you. And based on that, I believe that the only way you can start to confront is if you earn the right to confront. And by earning the right, I mean that you develop a connection, a relationship. In Hungary, and I think in most of Eastern Europe, I don't know about other parts of Europe, but in Hungary, there's a very strong conviction that you do not show anything of yourself to the client. You don't show any of your value system, any of your ideas. You just are present with them. My experience is that when my professors used to stay back in Ashland, Ohio, that at graduation, our professor, Dr. Palmerton, said to us, "Now you know many techniques. You're really good at diagnosis. But do not forget that it is you and your personality with the Holy Spirit that will heal people." And I really think that that connection has to be made in order to spirit to flow through you, because techniques do only part-time job and partial job. Any other?
Coming back to what you just said, and coming back to what Glenn talked about acceptance, showing acceptance with everything who we are as a therapist, I mean, with our gestures, with our reaction to his stories, because the way we react sometimes can show really clearly that we are not really accepting the person. So I think acceptance is very important here at the very first point of meeting.
Yes, thank you. Agree.
I mean, clearly he's going to understand some spiritual language being a Jehovah's Witness, so the acceptance that Christ showed to a prostitute, and you might want to bring that in, I don't know, but he's going to understand some spiritual language, so to show how God would accept him despite the situation.
Yes. One of the reasons I asked him of the God image, because I wanted to bring that in. Yeah. Even with atheists who, for some reason, seem to enjoy coming to see me, I always declare, you know, I am a Christian, and I put my life in God's hand on a daily basis. Actually, before I came to session, I prayed for you. I told this to them. And I'm very protective of their freedom, and I really would like you to understand this, that I try to let them feel that I am not going to convince them of any faith, but I also tell them that I will not remove my faith from me or from my words. So in this case, I asked him many questions, and I always, once I asked him, I always ask him, may I share with you what I think about this? Can we just compare our views? And since we have 5 more minutes, I would like to show where he is now. Later, his sexual addiction to pornography, he used sexual addiction to pornography to relieve frustration. We discovered that together. His sexual addiction to prostitutes he used to prove his worth. So he did that. I want to discriminate between the two, because he used pornography to relieve. When he was angry, he just ran and took care of himself with a selfish way. When he went to prostitutes, it always had a kind of a note in the back of his head that they will reflect to me that I am worth something. And he always did this when somebody crossed his boundaries. See, remember his father? His father did not allow him to have boundaries. So he did not know how to have boundaries. Very interesting that his fiancée, with all the reasons, was very angry at him and wanted to have all the details of counseling. And one of the first things I had to do was pull boundaries between him and his fiancée. Because on the long run, she needed a man who she could look up to. What is happening now? He has been free from prostitutes for 2 years. That was about a year after he came to see me. I saw him every 2 weeks for almost a year. And he has been free of action for 2 years. He's still fighting with pornography. Right now, his time between use of pornography, between the relapses, has increased to about 6 to 8 weeks. Instead of using it several times a day. He has developed a vision for leadership at work, which is very important because we talked about he had no vision. And he's getting married this summer. Later on I will talk to you about how relapses come and how we need to stand by them. But I wanted to bring to you a case that I have been working on really hard for now 3 years. The last year and a half, I have been seeing him only once a month. He comes in once a month and we talk and we go over certain details of his life. He's one of the longest of my clients. But with addiction, I don't think we can say that you are done. You need to go and have an ongoing relationship. And with Christians, it's a lot easier because you can have somebody from the church. He doesn't have anybody. He doesn't have anybody. Thank you.
Thank you.